Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
I felt we made an embarrassing contrast to the open serenity of the scene around us. The pure blue of the sky was unmarked by a single cloud or bird, and nothing stirred on the vast stretch of beach except ourselves. The sea, sparkling under the freshness of the early morning sun, looked invitingly clean. I wanted to wade into it and wash myself, but I was afraid I would contaminate it. We are a contamination here, I thought. We're like a group of sticky bugs crawling in an ugly little crowd over polished marble. If I were God and looked down and saw us, lugging our baskets and our silly bright blankets, I would step on us and squash us with my foot. We should have been lovers or monks in such a place, but we were only a crowd of bored and boring drunks. You were always drunk when you were with Carl. Good old, mean old Carl was the greatest little drink pourer in the world. He used drinks like other types of sadists used whips. He kept beating you with them until you dropped or sobbed or went mad, and he enjoyed every step of the process.
Boy, I have been both the Carl and the easy victim of Carl. And I've also here and there thought that humans were a contamination on the Earth.
You and me both. These aren't unique experiences, but this is quite a unique story. The sea was wet as wet can be, by Gayan Wilson.
We're tugging along a loose thread of stories this month here and there, inspired by poems from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland books. And while we kicked off the month with the science fiction tale in that vein, Mimsy, Where the Borogoves, I'd say this is pretty solidly in the horror or weird fiction category.
For sure. And it's a perfect candidate for Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. You're joining us here on Patreon. Thank you for subscribing. You can also find the whole index of stories we've covered in the last 13 evil years at strangestudies.com and hppodcraft.com. I came across this story in a resource we've actually tapped before, The Weird, a compendium of strange and dark stories edited by Anne and Jeff Vandermeer. You know, Jeff Vandermeer is the Annihilation author, and that's a really good collection.
Yeah.
This story is in.
Although, this story was actually first published in the May 1967 issue of Playboy magazine.
The old joke was, I only read Playboy for the articles, but there actually was a lot of good fiction in that magazine.
Oh, yeah.
It was, after all, a gentleman's magazine. You can also find it reprinted in the Playboy Book of Horror and the Supernatural, which came out as well in 67. Yeah, it's chock full of 50s and 60s tales. I looked at the table of contents and I haven't read or heard of most of them,
oh, wow.
Even though there's Robert Bloch stuff in there, Bradbury stuff in there. So I'm going to be examining that table of contents to see if there's more we can pull from it. But this story has been reprinted many, many times since then. It's been translated into French. It's a really good one.
Yeah.
Speaking of good ones, who was that reader?
That was Eric Peabody.
Yes.
He is the rocker behind Viking Guitar Productions and your man if you need audio and podcast production assistance, mixing and mastering for music, any of that audio jazz, he is the guy.
Yeah, I don't know if he mixes jazz, but he probably does. Metal guys don't seem to like jazz, at least that's what I get from Spinal Tap interviews. They've described it as just playing wrong notes. Eric is awesome, and we're glad to have him back on the new show as one of our recurrent readers, so grab him up as a narrator or throw him your music and audio business. Now, on this story, again, I actually haven't read the two Alice books, although I'm taking steps to rectify that.
Yeah.
I just picked up the collection of the two books from our local secondhand bookshop and started reading it last night. I'm through the first three chapters. It's all pretty familiar to me so far, but I figured it was time I read it, this Victorian classic. And we're going to talk Alice in a more general sense for our bonus episode. I'm sure I won't be through both books by then, but I also wanted to kind of have a loose discussion about the many, many films. I'm going to watch the Disney one. And then there's some really crazy earlier ones. It's been being made and remade since the film started.
Yeah, crazy.
But just as our first story was based on the poem Jabberwocky, this story is based on a poem as well. The Walrus and the Carpenter is the name of that poem. It appears in Through the Looking Glass, which was published in 1871, by the way. I don't know if people know the timing of all this when I say Victorian. But the poem is recited in Chapter 4 by Tweedledum and Tweedledee to Alice. I read the story first. Were you familiar with the poem?
No, never read it before.
Yeah, so I feel like it's sort of a horror retelling of that poem, but in a style that reminded me of Raymond Carver, who's an author we talk about a lot.
Yeah.
His short story writing success came a little later, but I know that 67 actually was a big year for him as well. He got his first big story published then. So he's a contemporary of today's author. You know, it's probably worthwhile to have Eric actually read that whole poem because it's not that long. Before we discuss the story, but before we do any of that, let's learn about this author.
Gayon Allen Wilson was born in Evanston, Illinois on February 18th, 1930.
Evanston, where B-Fest is held.
Now, he was a hugely well-known cartoonist. He's been in Playboy and Collier's and New Yorker, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. Lots of stuff. I mean, if you saw his work, you would go, oh, that guy. Yeah. I know him. He has kind of really stout characters, and they're all kind of bulgy and tentacle-like almost and creepy. Very distinct style. Nobody draw or drew like him. He's a very unique guy. I just recently watched an interview with him on a show called Dark Dreamers, which I discovered online. Holy cow, the dude that hosts it, he's called Stanley Wieter, W-I-A-T-E-R. In my opinion, he must be the origin of Garth Marenghi. Like, this guy really is unbelievably corny, but serious. What brought you into the dark realms?
Oh my God, I gotta check it out.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But he means it, huh? He's gotta mean it.
Oh, he means it for sure.
Dark Dreamers. Well, Gayon Wilson's cartoons for Playboy, as you say, pretty iconic, and they do have all sorts of supernatural and weird, you know, werewolves and vampires and Cthulhu-looking things in them.
Yeah.
I will link out, I found a remembrance that Neil Gaiman wrote about him after his passing. Mm-hmm. Here's a description I thought was interesting of the author. Gaiman writes, "In person, Gayon is tall. His face might possibly have been made out of plasticine, but he is, and I doubt he will mind me telling you this, significantly better looking than many of the people, some of the monsters, and all of the aliens that he draws. He is, in person, a funny man, not with the compulsive joke-making, look at me funny of comedians, but with a comfortably wry view of the world that he communicates with ease. He is affable and intelligent. He does not seem like a cartoonist. Were I to pick a profession for him based on his looks, it would be that of successful small-town mortician, I think, or owner of a backwoods motel. Or an alien, squished uncomfortably into a Gayon Wilson-shaped humanoid bodysuit, here to observe our ways and taste our wine and despoil our women."
He was a self-proclaimed weird kid. He loved going to the freak show when he was a child. His dad hated it, but he took him anyway. He said this about the freaks at the show. He saw them as being strong. Like, they were strong people that weren't afraid of being different. They had a power about them that he thought was kind of hypnotic. He grew up in Evanston, and he liked the kind, gentle Midwest attitude that's there. But he also annoyed by the overly optimistic view people had, and he appreciated the balance. You've got to have nice things, but you also got to deal with the dark stuff too.
I have a lot of close friends from Evanston. It is a kind, gentle, and also weird place. if you check out the banner of our Facebook page, actually, it's an illustration that was done for us by cartoonist George Eckhart, also from Evanston, now the caricature artist for Second City in Chicago. Yay. And I actually just the other day learned that Sean Evans, so random, the host of Hot Ones, if you've watched that.
Oh, yeah.
On YouTube. He's from Evanston as well. So another artist who produces hallucinatory experiences from Evanston.
The first cartoon Wilson sold was in a Ziff Davis magazine. He doesn't know which one in the interview that I watched, but he said he sold it for $7.50.
That's pretty good.
Notably, he designed the bust of H.P. Lovecraft for the World Fantasy Award, which was recently gotten rid of. But he actually received the award for Lifetime Achievement in 1981.
From the World Fantasy?
Yeah.
Got it. He got his own award. That's pretty cool. I didn't know that was his. Well, as I looked through his comics, I realized that I did know his art pretty well. I'm sure a lot of people will find that.
Wilson died in 2019 from complications due to dementia. And I remember that. I remember when that was in the news.
Well, this story is relatively short. It contains a lot of excerpts from The Walrus and the Carpenter. In notes, we were saying them, but then I thought, well, why don't we just read the poem at the top and or rather have Eric do it so that we can understand maybe, because the main character in the story is very familiar with the poem, and I think it's sort of assumed that we are as well. So, Eric, take it away.
The Walrus and the Carpenter. The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright. And this was odd, because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily, because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was done. "It's very rude of him," she said, "to come and spoil the fun." The sea was wet as wet could be, the sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud, because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead. there were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If 7 maids with 7 mops swept it for half a year, do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. Oh, oysters, come and walk with us, the walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than 4 to give a hand to each. The eldest oyster looked at him, but never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But 4 young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat. And this was odd because, you know, they hadn't any feet. 4 other oysters followed them, and yet another 4. And thick and fast they came at last, and more and more and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock, conveniently low. And all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. But wait a bit, the oysters cried, before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat. No hurry, said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. A loaf of bread, the walrus said, is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar besides are very good indeed. Now, if you're ready, oysters dear, we can begin to feed. But not on us, the oysters cried, turning a little blue. After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do. The night is fine, the walrus said. Do you admire the view? It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice. The carpenter said nothing, but cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice. It seems a shame, the walrus said, to play them such a trick. After we've brought them out so far and made them trot so quick. The carpenter said nothing, but the butter's spread too thick. I weep for you, the walrus said. I deeply sympathize. With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. Oh, oysters, said the carpenter, you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again? But answer came there none. And this was scarcely odd because they'd eaten every one.
So that is, like Jabberwocky, widely considered a nonsense poem. But is it nonsense? What do you take away from that?
I don't think it is nonsense at all. Maybe it's because I've read this story, but it seems like people taking advantage of other people, you know, the walrus and the carpenter taking advantage of the oysters, tricking them into thinking that they're friends, and then eating them.
Yeah. Now, I found some interesting questions and thoughts about this in an article on the Wisdom Daily. It was called The Wisdom in Carol's Nonsensical Poem, The Walrus and the Carpenter. I'll quote from that.
Okay.
It says, while some may say this poem is the very reason your mother told you not to play with your food, I find myself caught up in the nonsense of the story itself. What is the significance of the walrus and carpenter? What exactly brought these two characters together? Why is the carpenter the only human in the story? And why does he lack the morality to tell his animal counterpart that it isn't polite to con small creatures into joining you for dinner? And why is the most nonsensical verse of all the one that convinces the oysters to leave their warm oyster beds for an unfortunate demise? Even more so, why does the wise oyster let the young oysters go in the first place? Why didn't he or she put up more of a fight? The imagery the story provides may act as a distraction to the reader, yet some have tried to attribute political, religious, and nationalistic ideas to the walrus and the carpenter. In The Annotated Alice, co-author Martin Gardner tells the story of the carpenter's fruition. When Lewis Carroll gave his manuscript to illustrator John Tenniel, he gave him the option of drawing either a carpenter, a butterfly, or a baronet, as each word would fit the poem's meter. Rumor has it that it was not Carroll who chose the carpenter, but Tenniel. It's just what he wanted to draw. Therefore, any symbolic interpretations of the carpenter are rendered null. The carpenter offers no significance to the poem other than his three-syllable convenience. And this begs the question, what else may be this way? It cautions the reader not to overanalyze or look for symbolism where symbolism does not necessarily exist. Carroll claims the Alice books were made for the imagination of children and not for the analysis of, quote, mad people, which I think is how he describes literary critics. The idea seems to suggest that sometimes man is overly curious. We have a tendency to search for the deeper meaning of a text as opposed to taking it at face value, which I'm trying to keep in mind as I read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, that it really is nonsense. But you can't help but feel that there's something. I know that's just the human urge.
That's part of why art is good. Somebody will create something and you're going to get out of it, maybe not what the author intended, but you're definitely going to get something out of it. And that has a reflection on what you think and what you feel and your ideas. And I think something like this, because there's so much detail in it, it's easy for us to make it mean something. And I think it's interesting how different people are going to interpret and find meaning from it. Remember when we did that documentary for The Chosen One where it was the cats?
Yeah.
We just had photos of cats. And then we described how the movie got made.
We didn't have interviews with us sitting around talking about that. Or the ones that we did weren't very good.
Yeah.
So we had to have a behind the scenes. So we wound up just having one of our voice actors tell the story of it. And in lieu of having video, we just put up pictures of cats that we took from the internet randomly.
But as you watched it, your brain started to think of the cats as the people that were being talked about in the it was completely random, and yet my mind kept going, oh, that one's Chad, that's, or oh, look how that cat looks a little angry in that picture, or that cat
that's
looks
so
worried
great.
You know,
yeah,
your mind does these things. And I think when you are given this, you know, what they say is nonsense, that you're gonna find meaning to it even if it's not intended.
That speaks to why it's important to be reading, not just, you know, not just watching television and watching movies where a lot of that is given to you. Half of the interaction is coming from the consumer of the entertainment. Although this is picking up a thread of a discussion we started last month when we covered Mad God, the Phil Tippett movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had a long conversation about art and abstract art and what it means and whether it's relevant, et cetera. And I would recommend that folks go check that out because people seem to respond to that discussion as well. So enough wind up. Let's talk through the story.
It begins on a beautiful summer day on a beach, not a cloud in the sky, but we have a group of drunks, and this is not people out partying, but proper alcoholics that are having a picnic and getting more and more drunk. Our narrator, Phil, mentions the guy who brought this party together, Carl. Carl is also most of their bosses. He's the guy in charge. They don't really say what they do. Or do they say what they do?
I think that they're in some sort of advertising business because our main character mentions that he's met all the Hollywood types. He's met all these slick ads. You know, he's written for ads in some way. So I think they're in a kind of Mad Men-esque kind of 60s company.
So they've been drinking all night, and Mandy suggested, that's one of the people there, that they go have a picnic the next day. So they basically crash at somebody's house, we can assume, and then they wake up and then they decide they're going to go have a picnic. So they pack food and, of course, a lot more booze. Mandy nags her husband, Horace, who's also there as well. She's a bit of a nag and he's a bit of a weak-willed individual.
Yeah, he gets yelled at by her and his kids, and he kind of seems to, if not just take it, to even want that to be happening. I thought the story did a great job of articulating that experience of being in a roving band of drunks, though. You know, it's not really my deal anymore, but I certainly spent a good portion of my 20s and 30s as part of that band. You have these aimless, highly emotional, yet meaningless benders with people. It's really the booze that you have in common.
Yeah.
And when you're a drunk like this, you're very quick to pick up on who else is part of that club. I love all the characterizations in the story, but I love that vampiric character of Carl. He's really the instigator, wants to keep people plied with drink, keep them drunk. I do think the main character says something about being in advertising, but maybe I'm just connecting it to my own life because I had an instigator boss like that when I worked at the agency. And a lot of my coworkers were heavy drinkers like me. And, you know, there was a core group of us. We'd really go after it like this. This whole deal's hitting a little closer to home than the Alice book I'm reading right now.
Well, sure. Yeah. Now, they drive to the beach, drunk, I think.
Of course.
And then they throw down a blanket, and here we are.
In my middle-aged lens and remembering what this kind of thing was like, all I could think about is how god-awful these people are going to feel after drinking for so long and then spending time out in the sun on the beach.
Oh, God. There is, of course, a tin of Spam. And it says here, when I saw it, I was suddenly overwhelmed with an absurd feeling of nostalgia. It reminded me of the war and of myself soldier boying up through Italy. It also reminded me of how long ago the whole thing had been and how little I'd done of what I dreamed I'd do back then.
Wow, that hits pretty hard.
Yeah.
My dad was a veteran and it would not allow Spam in the house for that reason, because it was, you know, a ration thing that you got as a soldier, and he couldn't stand it because he had to eat so much of it in the war.
Oh. I used to love Spam when I was a kid.
It's great on Hawaiian pizza.
Not anymore. I'm vegetarian.
Is Spam an animal? I mean, Spam's not real, is it? It's just made out of dreams and...
Dreams and nightmares.
Yeah, dreams and nightmares. That's what goes into Spam.
Phil says about this group, the kind of people who run with people like Carl don't like to be alone, ever, especially with their memories.
Now, what did you make of that comment?
Well, I think that they're a bunch of really sad, depressed people, and if they keep themselves drunk, they're not going to have to deal with any of that stuff.
Yeah, right. Like he did just now when he's just remembering all the things he thought he was going to do that he didn't do. Mm-hmm. You got to keep distracting yourself from things like that.
And then all of these people need to distract themselves from whatever demons they've got going on.
Yeah.
And so they just keep drinking, and they keep each other drinking to keep each other distracted. So this woman, Irene, can see Phil is not doing well, and she's very sensitive to people in general, but she's had a rough time in the past as well. She's had depression and multiple suicide attempts.
She goes to him because he's by himself staring off into the ocean. And of course, times she's found herself doing that, it's led to suicide attempts. So that's why she's trying to help him out.
So Irene tells Phil that she's worried about Maddie, that Maddie seems unhappy. Phil looks over at Maddie and she's laughing her head off at some joke Carl just made. So she doesn't look too unhappy right there, but Phil's response is kind of dark. He says, why should Maddie be happy? What in God's name has she got to be happy about? He's got a low opinion of these people.
Is he talking about her specifically or just people in general, you know? We're finding all of these characters in a pretty dark place.
So Irene retorts, well, she's alive. She's got that to be happy about.
I looked at her and wondered what such a statement meant, coming from someone who tried to do herself in as earnestly and as frequently as Irene. I sort of thought about that too. You know, what do you think she means?
Obviously, she appreciates life in some way, or maybe she appreciates other people's lives and not her own. I don't know. There's a lot going on in the story.
There really is, yeah.
So in the distance, they see two people walking down the beach, and Phil points out that they've got company. So Carl starts shouting, hey, this is a private beach. Get out of here. But then he doesn't actually know if it is a private beach, and it definitely is not his private beach. He does not own any beach property.
No, and it seems to be kind of a joke Carl makes a lot, like a lot of his jokes are structured around, hey, this is my place, even though it's clearly not. Mm-hmm. I loved this bit of character detail. Carl had fantasies about owning things and having power. Now and then he got drunk enough to have little flashes of believing he was king of the world. It's that kind of thing where what people joke about might be telling you something deeper psychologically about them.
Now, Mandy tells him to cool it because it might be their beach that they're on, these strangers. And the strangers seem to be walking straight toward them.
For heaven's sake, said Irene. The little one's wearing a square hat. I think it's made of paper, said Mandy, squinting. Folded newspaper. Will you look at the mustache on the big bastard? Asked Carl. I don't think I've ever seen a bigger bush in my life. They remind me of something, I said. The others turned to look at me. They remind me of the walrus and the carpenter, I said. The who? Asked Mandy. Don't tell me you've never heard of the walrus and the carpenter, asked Carl. Never once, said Mandy. Disgusting, said Carl. You're an uncultured bitch. The Walrus and the Carpenter are probably two of the most famous characters in literature. They're in a poem by Lewis Carroll in one of the Alice books.
Did Carl just call us uncultured bitches?
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh, man. Because I wasn't familiar with the poem, not like Jabberwocky.
No, I'd never heard this poem before. So, yeah, I guess I am also an uncultured bitch, according to Carl.
According to Carl.
Now, Irene notes that the little one does have a handkerchief, and he's carrying a saw, and he's wearing an apron, just like the illustrations by Tenniel, which I'm blown away that these people know the illustrations in the book that I've never read. but they know it. It's important.
Yeah.
They know what's going on. So the approaching pair just then seem to notice the party, and they look a bit surprised that people are there, and then they walk over to them. Then out of the blue, it says, I had come to the decision that I was going to quit working for Carl, that I didn't like any of these people about me, except maybe Irene, and these two strangers gave me the honest creeps.
I hope that's true. Well, this story gets really weird, so who knows what's going to happen after the conclusion of this story, but it is that idea of you could be in a group and everybody's doing the same dumb thing, and so you don't even see it, but the minute it's observed,
yeah,
even if it's by strangers or these intruders approaching the group, it produces this moment of clarity for him. I got to stop doing this. I got to get out of this. And that's kind of a key insight for what's about to happen.
Yeah. He's able to imagine what these people think of them. He's got that much self-awareness. And when he has that mirror kind of flashback at him, it makes him reconsider his life. But when this walrus man smiles, everything changes. The smile of the walrus did what a smile hasn't done for me in years. It melted my heart. I used the cornball phrase very much on purpose. When I saw his smile, I knew I could trust him. I felt in my marrow that he was gentle and sweet and had nothing but the best intentions. His resemblance to the walrus in the poem ceased being vaguely chilling and became warmly comical. I loved him as I had loved the teddy bear of my childhood.
You know, I didn't really know what was going on when I read the story initially because I hadn't read the poem yet.
Yeah, no, me neither.
But after reading it, I thought, oh, they're putting these people at ease because they're the oysters.
Yeah. So the man, who is walrus-like, says, I hope we're not intruding. And the carpenter says, well, I think we are. The walrus explains that they were talking and didn't notice that there were other people on the beach. This reminds Phil of the poem. Were you talking about the sand? Phil asks. And this startles the walrus. And he says, why, yes, we were talking about the sand.
Uh-oh.
So the carpenter complains about the sand. And that reminds Phil of the next part of the poem about the seven maids clearing it all off. And Carl says, it's too much. Yes, indeed, said the walrus, eyeing the sand around him with vague disapproval, altogether too much. They're almost in a sense recreating what is happening in this poem.
Yeah.
So they introduce themselves. The walrus guy's name is George Tweedy, and the carpenter is Edward Farr. They confess that they, too, are a bit drunk, and they have just come from a party down the beach, and they were looking for some driftwood for a fire. But Carl says, I figured you were looking for oysters, which again startles the walrus. George says that we have oysters, just no way to cook them.
George is the walrus guy.
Yes, yes. And Carl is being overly kind, maybe because the walrus has the same effect on him as he does on Phil. Mm. Carl offers George and Edward an invitation, and Phil says that there's a light in Carl's eyes that he's never seen before. I'm not saying Carl had fishy, blank eyes, not at all. On the surface, that is. On the surface, with his eyes, with his face, with the handling of his entire body, Carl was a master of animation and expression, but only on the surface. Once you got to know Carl, and it took a while, you realized that none of it was really happening. That was because Carl had died or had been killed long ago, possibly in childhood. Possibly he had been born dead. So under the actor's warmth and rage, the eyes were always the eyes of a corpse.
That's really quite the characterization.
Yeah.
But I feel like I've known folks like that. And, you know, this story has been republished in one or two vampire anthologies as well. You might think that's because of the oyster eating that's going to happen later on. But I actually think it's because of this character of Carl, this instigator, the guy who's getting everybody drunk and sort of controlling them.
Now, George accepts the invitation, the walrus guy, and they join the group and then they all drink. It says, it soon turned out that the drinking we'd done before had only scratched the surface. Tweedy and Farr were magnificent boozers, and their gusto encouraged us all to follow suit. So the walrus talks and he tells stories. He's quite the raconteur and is generally a delight. And this causes Phil to remember more of the poem.
He says, we drank absurd toasts. We were delighted to discover that Tweedy had a specialty of outrageous fantasy, wild tales involving incongruous objects, events, and characters. So that's very much like the shoes and ships and cabbages and kings and pigs having wings.
Everyone is having a genuinely good time. Real smiles abound. Irene looked happy, honestly and truly happy. She, too, had found the secret. No more pills for Irene, I thought. Now she knows the secret. Now that she's met Tweedy, who's given her the secret, she'll have no more need for those goddamn pills.
And this secret that she's found, it's actually pretty profound. Early, right before that, he says, I began to wonder why in hell I'd spent my life being such a gloomy, moody son of a bitch, been such a distrustful and suspicious bastard, when the whole secret of everything, the whole core secret, was simply to enjoy it, to take it as it came. There's this little kernel of wisdom in there. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, well, wait, is the spell being cast over me as well?
So Mandy and her husband, Horace, they're actually snuggling each other, which Phil had never seen before. Like, they're showing affection to one another. Phil looks at himself in the moment, and then he looks out at the sea, and then he realizes that it's actually become quite cold, and he thinks about the poem more, and how the beginning, the description in the beginning of the poem, is actually a description of a lifeless earth, where there are no clouds and there's no birds in the sky.
Yeah, he's had this perspective change.
So Phil hears Carl say, "Great idea, Tweety," and everybody starts getting up. They're all beaming and smiling, but not with happiness. And Phil can see that now. Before he couldn't. Now he sees that it's almost fake. They can see Phil is lost in thought. And then they say, "Hey, if we're going to go over to George Tweedy's party." And George the Walrus says, personally to Phil, "You should come with us. It's only a pleasant walk." Just then, the smile that Walrus George had isn't working on Phil. The effect is gone. And he tells the Walrus, "You cannot do with more than four," which is from the poem. And Mandy doesn't understand why Phil's flaking out on them, but strangely, Carl seems to know what's up. He says he's hung up on that goddamn poem. Lewis Carroll's got that yellow bastard scared. Carl has some kind of awareness of the situation. He remembers the poem, he remembers what happens, and he can understand that Phil sees him and them as the oysters, but he doesn't care.
I feel like Carl is, you know, he's sort of the creative director or something at this agency where he works with lots of writers day in and day out. So he's like, he has knowledge of literature and things. He probably got a degree in that kind of thing himself, but because he's this soulless dead person, it doesn't have any effect on him. It's just knowledge, no interpretive value.
Yeah, or maybe he does understand his fate and he accepts it.
Yeah, there's that too. Yeah, possibly.
So he tells the others to forget Phil and he begins walking off with everybody except for Irene. She asks Phil if he's sure he doesn't want to come along and he looks at her. She looked frail and thin against the sunlight. I realized there really wasn't much of her and that what there was had taken a terrible beating. And he asks her if she really wants to go and she says, "Of course." And he says, "I suppose you do. I suppose there's really no stopping you." "No, Phil, there isn't." And then she stooped and kissed me very gently. And I could feel the dry, chapped surface of her lips and the faint warmth of her breath.
So I think, you know, he's the eldest oyster from the poem, the one that's like, "Nah, I'm fine in my oyster bed." And maybe it's what you said, you know, the reason that earlier question, why did the elder oyster let the younger ones go? And it's that same kind of thing. That realization isn't. It's internal, you know. Yeah. He's just, it's that secret. He's like, I'm going to stop. That stroke of insight is taking life as it comes rather than running off to chase it by roaming from party to party or constantly getting intoxicated in order to stop thinking your thoughts.
Yeah. So he stands up and he watches them walk away.
He looks at the sky for a moment after they've gone. It takes him a minute, but then he's like, "Well, maybe this isn't like the poem. Maybe this is the poem." But there's some description of him physically that hit home a little too hard where he goes, "I began to run up the beach toward the bluff. I stumbled now and then because I had too much to drink." He thinks, "I did all the wrong things, none of the right things." You know, he's totally out of shape and I smoked too much. I drank too much.
Yeah.
But he manages to get to where they should be.
He finally rounds the bluff and stops and drops to his knees.
Yep, pretty horrific revelation here.
It says, "Nothing stirred, but they were there. Irene and Mandy and Carl and Horace were there. And four others too, just around the bluff." The walrus and the carpenter had taken two trips. Phil crawls over to the bodies.
The other four had had a picnic too, very like our own. They too had plastic cups and plates. And they too had brought bottles. They had sat and waited for the return of the walrus and the carpenter. Irene was right in front of me. Her eyes were open and stared at, but did not see, the sky. The pure, blue, uncluttered sky. There were a few grains of sand in her left eye. Her face was almost clear of blood. There were only a few flecks of it on her lower chin. The spray from the huge wound in her chest seemed to have traveled mainly downward and to the right. I stretched out my arm and touched her hand. "Irene," I said. But answer came there none, and this was scarcely odd, because they'd eaten every one. I looked up at the others. Like Irene, they were, all of them, dead. The walrus and the carpenter had eaten the oysters and left the shell. The carpenter never found any firewood, and so they'd eaten them raw. You can eat oysters raw if you want to. I said her name once more, just for the record, and then I stood and turned from them and walked to the bluff. I rounded the bluff and the beach stretched before me, vast, smooth, empty, and remote. Even as I ran upon it, away from them, it was remote.
That's the end of the story.
Dark and weird.
Yeah, oysters are what do you call it, bivalve organisms, and the heart's full of valves, so that's the oyster, and everything else around it's the shell.
Mm.
The author actually has a note at the end of this. I don't know if it was included in the Playboy publication, but it was in where I pulled this from the internet.
Yeah.
And this is what it says. I distrusted the Alice books from the start. My grown-ups tried to pretend they were children's books and that I should and would enjoy them, so they officially shuffled them in with Oz and Pooh and the rest of the collection, but I knew better. I knew they were dangerous, and I opened them only rarely and gingerly. Of course, Tenniel's Jabberwock leapt out at me from the start, as it has, I'm sure, at many another innocent child, but there were many other horrors. The simultaneously fading and grinning cat, the impeccably cruel Duchess with her little boy, something about Bill the Lizard floating helplessly over the chimney, the crazed creatures at the tea party. The worst part of it was the thing that pervaded all those images and all the other images in the books, which I knew weren't about any wonderland at all, but about the very world I was trying to grow up in, only seen from some terrifyingly sophisticated point of view. The weird convincingness of Carol's horrible message that nothing, nothing so ever made any sense at all. If it hadn't been for brave, stolid Alice, bless her stout young British heart, herself a child, I don't think I could have survived those goddamn books. But there is no Alice in this story.
Wow.
It is scary stuff. I mean, even reading these first three chapters, I say, okay, she goes down the rabbit hole. She's in that underground thing. There are the doors, and she shrinks and she grows. But then while she's large, she cries these tears, and all of these other animals are drowning in the tears.
Yeah.
And they have a long conversation about, she keeps bringing up her dog and cat. But these are all birds and mice, and they're prey to those animals.
Right.
So they get real uptight and they hate her talking about it. She keeps saying the wrong thing. So there's this real who's eating and who's going to be eaten awareness right away in the book. It's about these real kind of horrific things. And her right away having to see her cat that she loves in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm bringing all that to it, but there's also something there besides just the nonsense.
Yeah. There's a reason why these stories have endured. And like, I mean, just when you said she went down the rabbit hole, like how that is a phrase in our language, in our culture.
Yeah.
You know, I went down the rabbit hole with this, and that's from Alice in Wonderland. You know, like it's permeated our culture in strange ways. There's a reason for it, because it does that in a way that other nonsensical things that I've read reflects back at you. You find meaning in there where maybe it wasn't necessarily intended, but it sure feels like it was.
It's sort of like when somebody will say, you know, they want to know the internal workings of something, and they'll say, let's open the kimono and see what's going on in there. And that's a reference to something I did in 1987. Nobody even knows that.
I've never heard that phrase before, Chad.
No, people do use that, and it's just so weird to me. But going down the rabbit hole, yeah, that's just gets thrown around all the time. Well, hey, I got to say thanks to Eric Peabody for the heavy text reading this week. Yeah. I threw a lot at him, but he did a great job with it, as always.
Handled it like a champ. And I also want to thank some of our patrons. Firstly, Franca Sky.
I want to thank Gary Schmidt.
Simon, thank you.
Will Bear, thank you.
Kyle Schiller, thank you.
Thank you, Ben Schultz.
Thank you, Behind the Beautiful.
Behind the Beautiful, see, that's about opening the kimono right there. I want to thank Steve Owens.
Effie, thank you.
And finally, Anthony Huat, thank you so much for being patrons. You guys are the best. We're going to be back next week with a story called Desertion by Clifford Simak. Lots of great stories flying out here. And then, of course, on our bonus episode, we're going to talk Alice. And then we've got a comments episode coming up this month as well. So please stay tuned, patrons. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.